Welcome back to the second half of After News with Amos. I'm Amos Brown. Glad to have you here. We probably spend in the 9 years on this show at least a third, maybe as much as 40% of the time talking about education, public education. And in the last 9 years, there have been a lot going on in education in Indiana, from charter schools to vouchers to school takeovers to I-STEP plus, end of course completion, I read this, that, and the other, school takeovers, school turnaround, schools having, you know, like five principals in 3 years, constant turnover, constant change, not just in IPS, but in the townships. And it all goes, even though in Indiana, there's almost 300 local school corporations. Educational policy in this state is set by an elected official, an individual with the title of Superintendent of Public Instruction. That office is up for election this year. Running against the incumbent, Dr. Tony Bennett, is a classroom teacher. And her name is Glenda Rich. She is the Democratic candidate for Superintendent of Public Instruction, and she joins me live. Welcome.
Thank you, Amos, for inviting me, and I'm most appreciative of the topic of education that you put on your radio station quite often.
So why are you running?
Well, I went to I have several reasons for running. I actually got into the race about 3 months ago because of the iRead 3 test that came up. When we started doing high-stakes testing at the state level for little 8-year-olds for retention, that's when I decided firmly that I was going to stand up for education. I want to give more time to education in the classroom and much less time to testing. Our students are more than test scores. I want to let local school districts and communities have more of a say in what works for their communities regarding state and federal policies that are in place. And then I want to work with communities and businesses to be sure to give more pathways for students toward graduation. And, of course, we want to be sure that we have licensing and teacher quality the highest in the nation, but do it with respect and professionalism and, of course, safety in the classrooms.
Are you, you've been a teacher?
I have been, 33 years.
33 years.
Yes.
You started out, when you started teaching, what grade, what level?
Well, I have multiple licenses, and I have two masters. I have taught at each level, elementary, middle school, and high school. I have degrees in special education, of which I've taught, general education, and library science. I'm currently the library media specialist at Crooked Creek Elementary School, grades K through 5.
So you're the pride of Crooked Creek.
I am. I like to think I am.
When we look at education in Indiana, if the people of Indiana say, Glenda Ritz, you're our new superintendent of public instruction, what would you do differently than what the current folk are doing now?
Well, one of the things that I would do first is to have some regional summits all around the state of Indiana, because I really need to get a firsthand knowledge of what is what needs to happen for challenges at each community level with the school districts. And I would rather see an approach with the Department of Education where we really know what the real issues are, and then the Department of Ed's job is to support that rather than a top-down, one-size-fits-all from the superintendent of public instruction. It's about doing things in a supportive manner rather than in a punitive manner, and making things work at each individual community school area.
239-1310. 239-1310's After News with Amos. We're with Glenda Ritz, the Democratic candidate for Superintendent of Public Instruction. You got education questions? You want to know what she would do about our schools? 239-1310. 239-1310. Or go to the website, praiseindy.com. Send me an email or go. Send me a text message at 85620, keyword Amos. 85620, keyword Amos. You mentioned iRead, that was kind of the final thing that pushed you over the edge. What did you see in iRead that concerned you?
Well, iRead requires that if you do not pass the test after the second try in June, that you will be retained in the eyes of the state of Indiana. The school district gets to physically decide if the student physically goes on to fourth grade or mm-hmm. remains in third grade. But in the eyes of Indiana, you're retained. Mm-hmm. There's a list kept, and those students will be responsible for taking that test again. I think that's a very punitive, detrimental way to be working with eight-year-olds in the improvement of reading. Many of the students that do not pass iRead are students that are, do not know the English language. I mean, just imagine taking a test in French mm-hmm. when you can't speak French, but being expected to pass that test at a grade level.
We went to Flatter House about 3-4 weeks ago, and we sat down with the principal at Flatter House and the third grade teacher and then another one of the teachers. And Flatter House had this strange anomaly that they had the lowest score in iRead of any public or charter school in the state of Indiana. Last on the list, basically 26% of the kids, those third graders passed iRead. Those same third graders in the same month took iStep. And 88% of those kids, all but two, passed iStep. English and language arts, and they also aced iStep math. And it's like, wait a minute. Same month, same kids. When I talked to the teachers, I said, did the kids say that they had any problems? They said, no, the kids thought they did well. And when I actually saw Dr. Bennett at John Marshall last week and told him about this, oh, that must be an anomaly. I'm sure there are other instances of young third graders in Indiana that passed iStep in English and language arts, didn't pass iRead or the reverse. Is this, in your mind, part of this absurdity of testing that we've gotten in Indiana?
Well, there's an assumption that those tests connect in some way, mm-hmm. and they don't. Not at all. One of the issues that teachers have had with iStep Plus for years and years is when they went from actually having a reading strand on the iStep test to having a language arts strand on the iStep test. There is really no way to disaggregate out the information about just reading with the iStep test. And so when the iRead came along, it's what I would consider in the teaching field to be a diagnostic test for instruction. Mm-hmm. And so it's got a phonics portion, a comprehension portion. It's got several portions to the reading test. And so they don't give the same information. So it doesn't surprise me that you could pass one test and not the other. Plus, it's a high-stakes test. You know, it's a one-day snapshot mm-hmm. of what kids do. It's not an overall picture of how a student reads.
One of the things that when I talked to the folks at Flatter House, I said, well, I've seen sample iStep questions, and it seems like iStep went out of its way to make sure that when they gave names of kids, there were multicultural names where there might be, quote-unquote, black names or Latino names or Asian names or, you know, common names. I said, did iRead do the same thing? And those teachers said no, and I'm going, wait a minute, that's a bell. If our main base test is multicultural or quasi-multicultural and iRead wasn't, I'd ask for a refund. If you get to be superintendent of public instruction, you're going to ask for a refund.
Well, actually, as superintendent of public instruction, I would probably not have iRead. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a necessary test that is needed for high-stakes testing for third grade. So I wouldn't have it anyhow, Amos.
Is there one of the arguments to have iRead is if a kid by third grade cannot read, they should not move to fourth grade. Now, this is the business community talking. Also, given the fact that most Hoosier households don't have kids that are in school, the average common sense Hoosier, whether they're black or white, is going to say, well, if the kid can't read by third grade, hold them back till they read. How do you answer that?
Well, retention has never been a case for remediation. That's not ever been a proven practice whereby students actually, after the second time of retention, you have a higher, much higher dropout rate of graduation. So we're in the business of making sure kids learn to read. And so you got to have a strong reading program. I can talk to what we did at Crooked Creek Elementary School. We put in a very strong K through 2 reading program. And our students who are not students of second language or do not have a disability in special education, they are reading by third grade. We have a very strong literacy program that's very supportive. We also have a culture of readers at Crooked Creek. Mm-hmm. I'm the media specialist, as I said, so I make sure that students are reading at home each night. Parents actually complete. We have a very good home school parent program going on with our reading. And we've got a culture of readers. Will every 100% of our students pass an on-level, grade-level test at third grade? No, because we have some students who just arrived at our school who do not speak English. We have some students who have severe disabilities in reading, and they won't pass that on grade level test. But we know where they are in reading. We know what level they're on. We know where we need to take them with reading. But just retaining them, that doesn't improve the reading scores.
239-1310. 239-1310 is afternoon's name is now. When these candidates come on, it's not just about me asking the questions. This is your opportunity to ask the questions of the people whose names will be on the ballot on Tuesday, November the 6th, when it's the finals. So let's start today with Cheryl. Cheryl, you're on with Glenda Ritz, Democratic candidate for Superintendent of Public Instruction. Hi there.
Good afternoon. I am just so grateful to hear that. I look at the kids, you know, and how they suffer in the school building. I don't think a lot of politicians see that. And that, you know, if you have a classroom of 23 kids, and a couple of kids, two kids, one kid, they identify him as not being or her not being able to read. And then it's an embarrassment in front of their peers and their friends that, you know, you can't read, so we're going to hold you back. And if you don't pass this test, we're going to hold you back for a year. That's humiliation. That's an insult to the kid. Now, we've got... I'm a taxpayer, and I think you should take my tax money and put some interventions in place. We know whether or not these children can read before they get to third grade. And so where is the preventative maintenance? And I appreciate the comments that you made, you know, about the program I heard earlier, how you've put that in place and how it's working. And I think we need to do a lot more than that. Instead of humiliating these children in front of their peers and telling them that they can't read and giving them a test and holding them back.
Well, ma'am, you are exactly right. That's why I got into this race, because that's what high-stakes testing does. It's a punitive approach to improving literacy, and that's the final reason that I got into the race. I really appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Amos.
I appreciate it, Cheryl. Thank you. Let me go to Anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
I just wonder how she feels about principals that think or feel that the students are more than a test score.
That's a good question.
The reason that we no longer have the principal at Shortridge is because he felt that the students were more than a test score.
Okay. Glenda?
Yeah, I'll be glad to respond to that. What you're experiencing is the pressure all the way up to the top. This is all about testing, and schools are doing anything and everything to make sure kids pass the test, from getting rid of curricular pieces that are necessary for a whole child's development so they can graduate and go into whatever work they want to go into, vocation. And so, yeah, that's exactly what happens. High-stakes testing produces that kind of piece. And principals that used to fight for the whole child and have a good, balanced curriculum piece are now about focused on test. Besides the state tests, the districts have gone to almost all school districts are testing kids all the time.
We do at least once a month.
It's more often than that. It's every week, every few weeks, and we're losing time for classroom instruction.
I appreciate Anonymous, I appreciate the call. Let me follow up on that. The other thing that I heard when we were out at Flanner House Charter School was they told me all the standardized and diagnostic tests, including tests on a computer, that they gave these third graders in March. So it wasn't just I-STEP. It was I-READ. It was MEAP, NEAP, some other, a couple of other acronyms that I've never heard of before. And I'm going, I didn't have these many tests in college. Now, granted, I went to college when Lincoln was around, but still, I don't recall that many then. It sounds like parents and grandparents and taxpayers don't know how many tests these kids are doing over and above the regular quizzes and tests and the end of the course tests that they have to do.
And the reason is because of the pressure of the high-stakes testing. Yeah, the districts feel that they need to have data and more data and more data to keep progress on how the kids are doing in their reading and their math. Mm-hmm. And so they give more tests, and they require us to give more tests and more assessments more often and more often and more often.
I'm going to ask the dumb question. What's wrong with the quiz that's in chapter four of the book? If you're doing math and you're on chapter four, at the end of chapter four, there's a quiz. Why can't you use that to measure? Well, if 20% of the kids fail, and you know, why can't you use that? It's in the book. You're supposed to be following the book.
Well, Amos, that, you know, that the issue is the classroom teachers have their own assessments as well. Mm-hmm. So, and we would prefer that our own assessments be the ones that are driving the instruction. But because of the high-stakes testing piece, we're required to do other test pieces that are more standardized so that the district can have the same information on all of the kids at the same time. And it is. It's out of control. It really is. And educators all over, and parents are starting to realize, oh my goodness, you know, we do not have in place a quality curriculum that's going to have well-rounded out individuals. We have curriculum that is teaching to the test.
239-1310, 239-1310, it's Afternoons with Amos. If you're elected superintendent of public instruction, what will you do with schools that have not progressed academically? That are either in the academic probation category, or if you want to use the letter grade, the F category, if you want to use a common sense grade, y'all ain't improved for a number of years. One can understand that maybe a school does well one year and maybe there's a shift in the student body or an influx of people that are new to a community for whatever reason, or a school gets closed and some other kids transfer in and maybe the school dips down, or, you know, great staff comes together, maybe new principal, new school leader, school goes up. So they got an up and down progress. But if somebody that's at the bottom for years and years and years, at what point would you pull the trigger that something has to be done?
Well, first of all, I guess I'm going to back up just a little bit, if I may, and say that the Department of Education, when Tony Bennett came on board, one of the first things that was cut from our budgets at the schools was professional development. There is no professional development for educators. Now, I'm talking about principals. I'm talking about all levels of educators. And as a result of that, we haven't been able to implement some things with quality. Mm-hmm. I am all about teacher quality right there in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And in where I work, professional development is something that we beg and borrow and try to find money to make happen. And so we are making sure that that's going to be in place, and so that we continue to have the quality of education in the classrooms. That's the first thing that needs to be reinstated, is professional development. Now it needs to be professional development according to what the local community districts need. And there needs to be a serious evaluation of that, not just looking at the test scores. It needs to be a comprehensive review. We need to hear from educators that are right there in the schools and talk with the constituents. I'm talking parents and community. I'm talking good constituency to be sure to move things forward. Now, when I am a stickler for things happening. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we put plans in place and they aren't going where they need to go, then we're going to need to get the troops together again, so to speak, and make sure that they're headed in the right direction. But I am a firm believer that if you got a good, strong plan and you're actually headed that way and professional development pieces are in place, then things start to improve.
I understand the importance of professional development of the teacher. But isn't it more important to have professional development at the school leader level, whether you call them principal or school leader or whatever? Isn't that the more critical piece now in education to have a, because you want this school leader to almost be, to have a multiplicity of disciplines and skills?
Well, I'm a firm believer that the principal, first of all, should be a good teacher. Mm-hmm. A good teacher makes a good principal. And so I think we have laxed a lot of our requirements on becoming an administrator, and you need to be a teacher first and foremost.
Where does people skills come into that? I understand the part about being a good teacher. I can mm-hmm. buy into that, but what about people skills? Because I hear horror stories from my listeners all the time of interactions that they have with schools, with principals, with school leaders, with administrators that obviously have had no professional development on how to deal with people.
Well, all that's needed. I agree. Leadership is vital for any school. But that even goes higher than that. Mm-hmm. You know, the school districts and the hiring practices and how that all works. But we need to evaluate all of that at the district level and the local level to see where do we need things that are going to make the improvements.
239-1310. Back to the phones and Anonymous. Hi there.
Hi. Glenda and Amos. I'd like Glenda to respond to the issue that this is just not here in Indiana. All over the United States, standardized test scores are used as an excuse to close schools and to charterize them and privatize them.
Well, Tony Bennett, that's all he's using. He's just using test scores to evaluate everything. Everything is built on that, even the system to grade the schools, his new A to F system. It's all built on looking at those single test scores that are taken each year. And do I think that it's about privatization as an agenda? Yes, I do. I think that's evident with the last legislature that talked about giving public dollars to private schools.
All right. Appreciate the call, my brother. Thank you. 239-1310. Back to the phones in George. Hi there.
Yes, Amos. How are you doing and your guest?
Fine.
Look, I would like to know from her if she would become the head person. What would she do pertaining to what happened to out there at Washington Township when they accused the teachers of cheating on those tests, helping the children? I guess that's what it was about. Can she elaborate on that a little?
That case is still under investigation by the Department of Education. Let me make it hypothetical. You're superintendent of public instruction. Your test administrators come in and say, we have found some evidence that some teachers may have cheated or broken the security rules of testing. What would be your position?
Well, I agree there should be an investigation, and there's a proper format already in place for an investigation to take place, and it happens at the local level, and they do the full investigation, and they make the determination on if there should be any disciplinary action taken against an educator for any particular reason. So I guess I would follow the same procedure in terms of having a fair investigation about what's going on.
Is that considered what has been alleged, and not just Washington Township, there's been some allegations in other districts. Is that like plagiarism? Is that like academic fraud, which is the most serious crime in a school setting? That it may sound to the ordinary person not a crime, but to educators, that's a big deal.
Well, I suppose you could make that case if they were actually taking questions and sharing the questions with the students. Mm-hmm. If that's not the case, then I would say no, that wouldn't be appropriate.
Let me go to Bill at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon, Amos.
Good afternoon.
Your candidate for public instructions. Let me ask the question relative to high-stakes testing. School corporations are faced with the reality that whether it's the federal government with No Child Left Behind or state government, states all across the nation, they are going to use test scores to measure the effectiveness of a school. Looking here in Indianapolis with schools being taken over based on the number of students that pass the test, That's a policy that flows from the state level. The state makes those policies as the head policymaker along with the State Board of Education. What would you encourage people to do to recognize that we've got 290-some school corporations in Indiana, that how would you give them more flexibility, and what would you recommend in lieu of the to evaluate whether or not a student is learning?
Well, you bring up a really good point, because that's probably my main focus of this entire campaign. Instead of giving achievement tests, which really, and I'll give you just a very simple analogy, if you give a fourth grade test, the fourth grade test is on a fourth grade level. And really the only information you get from that is that the student either passed it or they failed it. I would recommend that we replace that entire system of achievement level testing with what you call growth level testing, in which we give a test at the fourth grade students would take a test on reading, just as an example, and you would really know what level of reading that child is on. So the students in your fourth grade, you would know that you have sixth grade readers in there, and you've got eighth grade readers, and you've got third grade readers. That way, the teacher really does now have instructional information to be able to purchase the proper materials for the students to read on any given topic that they might be studying. That's what educators are craving to have, to really know what are the levels of the students in their classroom, and then at the end of the year, how have they improved on their levels of reading in the classroom, rather than a pass-fail approach, which is really what's happening in the education system now.
Bill Crawford, you still with us?
My best wishes.
Bill Crawford, I got to ask you a question. I had not asked Glenda Ritz this question yet, but since you're on the line, Bill Crawford, State Representative, I got to ask you your reaction to the news that we're hearing this afternoon that the next president of Purdue will be the sitting governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels. And does that raise some questions about conflict of interest by Purdue board members he appointed, and maybe Purdue board members whose businesses are doing business with the state voting on the sitting governor to be the next president of a state-run university?
I think it does raise some instance, but it's not unprecedented. Donna Shalala, who was in the Clinton cabinet, is president of a university, a former senator, and someone.
I think it was precluded. Okay.
But I do think it raises some appearance of impropriety.
All right, State Representative Bill Crawford, appreciate that. 239-1310, 239-1310 is Afternoon's Namus. When we come back, more of your questions to Glenda Ritz. She wants to be superintendent of public instruction. We're going to talk about special ed, because she kind of does special ed. We'll talk about school leadership. We'll talk about charter schools. Where does she stand on that? Your opportunity to find out where she stands on the education issues important to you. 239-1310, 239-1310's Afternoon's Name is more after these. With Glenda Ritz, she is the Democratic candidate for superintendent of public instruction. Charter schools have now been around for almost 10 years. I think next year will be the 10-year anniversary of charter schools. If you become superintendent of public instruction, what's your position on charter schools? You would be in charge of this new state charter school board that seems to want to put charter schools on every street corner like they're drugstores.
Well, first of all, I'd have to really wrap my head around this new board that's been created and figure out what its purpose is supposed to be. But in the law, charters are public schools. Mm-hmm. And so in my personal view, public schools should all, no matter whether they're charters or public schools, they should be held to the same standards, same qualifications, and have equity in the funding. I think that you're going to that you need to have equity amongst them.
The superintendent of public instruction has been quick to criticize public schools that are not achieving. Yet the superintendent of public instruction, the incumbent, has been silent over charter schools that are not achieving. The most egregious example are the Imagine schools in Fort Wayne and here in Indianapolis that have been on the academic lack of progress list from day one. if you're superintendent of public instruction and you're trying to hold everybody, you know, accountable, would that include public schools that are not performing, that have been chartered by the mayor of Indianapolis or Ball State University, as well as under this new state charter school board?
Oh, most definitely. I think there just needs to be total equity in how that all of this is approached. Tony Bennett has been blaming educators, public schools. He's been doing the blame game now for 4 years. And he doesn't like to point out that many of the charter schools are not performing, even as well as the public school pieces, counterparts. And so I just think there needs to be equity. I'm not necessarily opposed to new schools being formed under a public charter. What I want to see is equity amongst all of them, so that they all have to play by the same rules and the same playing field, so to speak.
Let me go to Jaxter at 239-1310. Hi there.
Good afternoon, Amos.
Good afternoon.
Oh, and guess I was wanting to ask, how do you feel about tenure in school, and can they give some teachers some tests to make sure they qualified to continue teaching? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you, ma'am.
Great question. One of the things, Glenda Ritz, that we hear on this program about teachers from listeners is teachers that in the caller's view may not be up to, you know, teaching today's kids. They're kind of lock brain, and you kind of talked about professional development a little bit earlier, or you've heard the phrase, they're in it for the paycheck, they're not in it for the kids. How do you have a public education system where you've got the best and the brightest, whether that's a veteran teacher or a brand new teacher? You got your best in the best positions, and those that aren't doing well need to go stand in line at work one.
Well, the viewer used the word tenure. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what he used.
Yeah.
I just want to disband that myth. There never has been something called tenure.
Tenure is not at the K through 12 level. That's a university thing.
No, there's no such thing.
Okay.
And so teachers are held to standards, or should be held to standards, by their principals regarding teacher evaluation and teacher quality. And then I'm going to take you right back to professional development. Mm-hmm. It's all about professional development. Education evolves, and there's always new things that we have to know and new things that we have to use with students, new technology pieces we have to have in place. You know, you have to get in the 21st century and be moving ahead. And so we always have to have professional development, and teacher quality is expected. Those teachers who know me, and administrators in Washington Township, will contest that I am a very big proponent of teacher quality. The highest teacher quality needs to happen in the classroom. And if teachers can, don't meet those standards, then they should be counseled out.
Should, in any teacher evaluation, should there be a place for parental evaluation and then, depending upon the grade, student evaluation?
Well, if you're talking about peer evaluation, I mean, there's different forms of evaluation. And in the actual piece where you're actually having somebody determine whether they're fired as a result of the evaluation, I think that's like, you know, the business kind of piece. You have that in place with that person, and that's the person you're going to deal with. Now, in my district, you know, teachers can voluntarily, you know, send out surveys to their parents and send out surveys to their students, and gather information and share that with their administrator. But to actually, I think parents and students have a role with the teacher in the classroom, with the curriculum and how that's run. And that's the best place to have that conversation.
If you're superintendent of public instruction, where does vocational education fit?
I am so glad you brought that up. And I know that was a topic of one of your latest shows. And the term used nowadays is career and tech ed, evolving into the 21st century. And I noticed that Pence had his program unveiled about what he wanted to do with that. And I agree, couldn't agree more. Actually, teachers have been...
There's common ground on that issue with
well,
you.
Well, that we need, yes, that we need more pathways for students to graduate, most definitely. But I want to tell you what the roadblock's been.
Okay.
The roadblock has been Algebra 1. And since Algebra 1 was instituted as the high-stakes test, end-of-course assessment, that students need to have to graduate, we have seen our vocational career and tech ed programs really start to diminish.
Why?
Because students have, there's no other math strands, no other math courses, I guess, that we can imply at the basic level. We have to do Algebra 1 and 2. We cannot have an alternative math course that would take students into those professions.
So is the business community misleading Indiana, misleading Hoosiers? Because the impression has been left that it's the business community that's demanding these increased skills. That's why every kid needs to take algebra, because you can't be a pipe fitter or steam fitter or understand the computer that fixes your car if you can't pass Algebra 1.
I don't think the business community has been demanding that at all. I think it's been decisions were made at the Department of Education several years back. It was met college prep only. Mm-hmm. And Algebra 1 was determined to be the gatekeeper to that end of the course assessment. We have students at my own high school, North Central High School, that take Algebra 1 course again and again and again. And again, and they can't take other courses, obviously, when they're taking Algebra 1 so many times. But that's diminished the district's focus on having multiple pathways, because we really do not have math courses. We can't have math courses by decree of the Department of Ed that will give students that kind of pathway towards some vocational pieces. Now, we have about 48 career centers throughout the state.
Right.
And we have students who are taking courses in vocational pieces. And we have high schools who have career and tech ed classes in place, like mm-hmm. business courses and consumer ed courses and things like that.
But because that Algebra 1 is the roadblock.
That's right. And no matter even if they take those courses, they cannot graduate from an Indiana high school without having passed Algebra 1. There are three degrees. One is general degree. One is the academic honors, the other one is the Core 40. But all of them require the passing of Algebra 1.
239-1310, 239-1310, afternoons. The name is back to the phones. And Jackie, hi there.
Okay, Amos, you already asked a question about the teacher parents evaluating the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And another part of that question, I know she mentioned that that's something that's done between the teacher and the parent. She's saying that it couldn't go beyond that, because I think it would be a good idea for the parents to evaluate the teachers. And not to say that they can be terminated for, you know, a bad evaluation from a parent, but just to get maybe better ways that they could do the classroom or something. I don't know. The worker, educational worker.
Well, the best way to resolve issues is at the classroom level with the teacher and the parent, and being able to have conversation about whatever the issue might be. But then there always is the option of working with the administrators and the administration higher up to resolve any issues.
But is the fear of having parents, even if it's a blind evaluation, evaluate teachers, that little petty school politics would enter into it? Or if a teacher's really great teacher and the parent knows it, that's going to come out, wouldn't it?
Can you rephrase your question a little
bit?
I think my
audience might say, hey, wait a minute. It makes sense to have parents evaluate teachers, because if they're a great teacher, that's going to come out in the evaluation. We'd want the school to know that. If the teacher was less than great, we would at least want to know that, or at least, you know, tell somebody that, and then the school could, you know, use that as part of the evaluation. As the caller said, not necessarily to use as the reason to dismiss somebody, but to allow the feedback to that teacher. Hey, you're doing a great job, or here's some things that have come in that maybe you ought to think about improving.
Well, I think you're talking about something similar that I mentioned.
Okay.
You know, perhaps parental surveys and perhaps student surveys that could be used by the teacher to help improve her own instruction.
All right, 239-1310. Thank you, Jackie. Back to the phones. And Tony, hi there.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Good. I have a question. It's about education, but it's a little bit different. I was wondering, is there a law on the books that stops a teacher coming out of college from being able to teach students somewhere within a 10 to 15 year age general. And I'm asking because of the different cases of the sexual misbehavior and things like that that have come up between teachers and students in the past.
Oh, so you're saying there ought to be, you know, if a kid just comes right out of college at age 22, they shouldn't be a teacher until maybe they're 30?
Well, they shouldn't teach high school students because they're in the same generation. They listen to the same music.
Oh.
They club the same. What's to stop them from falling in love and engaging in misbehavior?
That's a great question. See, we got the smartest talk show audience in the whole country. How would you deal with that, Glenda Ritz?
Well, I don't know. I guess we have teachers all the time that actually graduate at 21 and head right into the classroom.
Let me rephrase that. How then do you make sure that young teachers, because usually they're the ones fresh, they're the ones with the new ideas, they're the ones that can invigorate a class. We hear all these great stories about young teachers and the impact that they have on school. How do you make sure that they conduct themselves professionally?
That's the question. And actually, that's something that I do in Washington Township. I work with young teachers to be sure that they understand and have cautions about how they are to be professional in the classroom. We do quite a bit of professional development with our young teachers. And I'm going to go right back to that same line item. There are no mentors anymore, no money for that anymore at the state budget. We used to have a mentoring program in the state of Indiana to help those younger teachers be sure that they were entering the profession and know what that professionalism is that they have to conduct, because now they are the actual instructor instead of the student coming right out of college. But yeah, that's important. Professional development of our young teachers is very important.
Appreciate it, Tony. Great question. Back to the phones. And Wanda, hi there.
Hey, Amos, here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I'm a parent. I have kids right now in Pike. And to me, I don't think I see as much problems with teachers as I see with parents. Parents who don't make their kids go to sleep on time. Parents who don't know how to teach their children to be respectful to adults. Parents who don't know how to make sure that their kids are coming to school prepared. And if you are talking about teachers doing their job, what about parents? Parents don't do their job.
What can the superintendent of public instruction do? Because this problem with parental involvement is everywhere in Indiana, not just in quote-unquote inner-city schools. What can a superintendent of public instruction do to engage parents?
Education certainly is a shared partnership. There is, like, no doubt about that. And our schools are really a little microcosm of our communities. And so we need to be working with parents. I think the strongest way to do that is through literacy programs. When you can engage your parents on the literacy aspect of their children, they start to have better communication with the parent, with the teachers at the school. I can speak for what happened at Crooked Creek.
Mm-hmm.
When parents come in or that necessarily are not, you know, providing what might be the best school environment at their homes.
Right.
You'd make sure homework's done, make sure the kids have gone to bed, you know, make sure things are happening. We really have the dialogue around reading. We really go back to the reading and have the dialogue, and we talk about, you know, is Johnny getting enough sleep each night? He seems to be tired in the morning when we're getting ready to do our reading instruction. And we just really keep working on that with the parents, and making sure that we have a culture of readers. I think reading bridges the gaps with everybody.
Do we need in this state to have a bill of rights and responsibilities for parents so that parents know when they, you know, put their kids in a public school what their rights are as parents, what that school district's obligations are to the parents, and the reverse, what that parent's responsibilities are to include get your kid on time, get them properly, you know, dealt with. If we call you to the school, you know, come running, as well as tell the business community, hey, if that employee has to go to the school, don't dock them pay, so a parent's not deciding between money in their pocket to pay the rent or going up to the school to see about their kid.
Well, I think many school districts have implemented something on paper regarding that. You know, they even give it to the parents when they come to school the first day of school. But I don't know that there's enough of that partnership piece going on. And it's about communication, Amos. I mean, it really is. It's about that higher level principal leadership culture, that there's going to be communication between the school and the home, regular communication.
Y'all have been asking, who's running against Tony Bennett for superintendent of public instruction? Glenda Ritz is. We'll be back with our many moments with her tomorrow. Kay Fleming. You're saying, who is she? She's the Democratic candidate for attorney general. Also tomorrow, we'll talk to a Tuskegee Airman, and then we will, yeah, really, and then we will keep our eye on the developing story. Can the governor learn how to wear Purdue black and gold? The rumor is he's the next president of Purdue University. No joke. I ain't joking about that. That's for real. This afternoon's with Amos after the end. Welcome back. We're with Glenda Ritz. Glenda, we have a bullying law on the books that every school and school corporation is supposed to have a written policy on bullying. It's not working. You know, if you're elected, what can you do about it?
Well, there are actually many programs out there on bullying. I'm going to go right back. I sound like a broken record, I know, Amos, but it's professional development. In Washington Township, we have positive behavior supports in place, but we need professional development on how we should be handling situations. There's a policy in place that has to be in place. You're exactly right on here's what should happen.
Is this in professional development, is this going out to New York or California and Florida and hiring high-priced consultants to do that? Or is this having people on staff in the Department of Education, whether they're in Indianapolis or regionally throughout the state, that can go out and work with schools?
Right here. It should be right here local. And that's part of what I want to do. Once I know that a particular community needs to have a focus on that, then we should have people of the Department of Ed that actually works with that. I was asked one time, you know, what about the structure of the Department of Ed? When you're a superintendent, what will you change? My response is, I don't know what I'm going to change yet, because I don't know what the needs are of the individual school communities. And when I find that out fairly quickly after I'm elected, then I will be putting into place the proper pieces to support whatever is needed at the local level. And bullying in some districts and discipline, handling discipline and managing classroom management is needed, where in other districts, that's not their focus.
She'll be back before the finals on November the 6th. She is the Democratic candidate for superintendent of public instruction, running on the same ticket with John Gregg for governor, Vi Simpson for lieutenant governor, and Kay Fleming for attorney general. You'll meet her tomorrow. Standard closing question, Glenda Ritz. If people want more information about your campaign, how do they get a hold of you?
Go to www.ritz4ed.com.
So that's Ritz, like the cracker, then the number 4, then ed.com.
Correct.
So Ritz4ed.com. Ritz4ed.com. And sometime starting tomorrow morning, if you missed any of the interview, you can catch it all, as all the candidate interviews are on praiseindy.com. So those of you that, you know, you're looking to cause trouble, just wait for it to go online, and you can download it and have all the fun. Glenda Ritz, in her first live broadcast interview, we'll give the evaluation later. Thanks very much for being with us. Glad to have you.